Right, okay. So good evening. And we are looking at Sedra Tetzaveh, but in order to get into that, we will be looking at the beginning of Truma as well. So we will take the beginning of Truma. So both of these parshiot are about the making of the sanctuary. And the sanctuary has a very special significance if one is looking at the spiritual history of the universe. The point about creation. Why should there be creation? What is the meaning of creation? Is that there is a divine desire. Now, the very idea of a divine desire is a very interesting concept, the divine desire. And then the word desire. You see, the Hebrew phrase is nit'aveh hakadosh baruch hu. God desired. A desire, there's a Yiddish phrase. Well, let's just see what he desired. He desired liyot lo yitbarach, that he should have he should have a dwelling in the lower world. That means in the world where godliness is hidden. And that's the whole nature of our world. It's a world of concealment. That in this realm, God desired to dwell. Now, of course, philosophically, one can question this. Why should God desire this? But there's a Yiddish phrase, for a desire, there are no questions. You know, someone likes, the image which is used is of a pregnant woman who suddenly decides she wants to have an omelette. I must have an omelette. 3 o'clock in the morning. Get up, I want an omelette. <She's, laughs> There's no kasha, you know. She doesn't have to give a philosophical explanation why she wants an omelette. So God desires to have a dwelling in the lower world. In other words, there should be a world of concealment, a world where godliness is hidden, and in that realm, godliness should be revealed, somehow or other. Two opposites, shnei hafachim. That at the same time, there should be a concealment of godliness, a physical world. That's what physical means. If you say spiritual, we imagine a spiritual realm. So in a spiritual realm, it's translucent. The godliness is apparent. A physical realm, the physicality hides the spiritual. Now, sometimes through a process of contemplation and great sensitivity, you can break through the barrier and despite the physicality of existence around you, whether you're looking at a beautiful tree or flower or mountain or something like that, one can see the spirituality. Yes, and there's an empathy and a sense of awareness of the infinite just coming from existence. You might be looking down a microscope at a crystal structure. It's so amazing, so beautiful. But of course, other things in the physical world confront us in a terrible way. How could God let that happen? What a terrible thing. And it hides godliness. And the darkness becomes much more intense, depending where you're looking. But the making of the sanctuary, that's actually a fulfillment of this process. At the very beginning of creation, there was the divine and Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And so there was this sense of the divine indwelling in the world, and Adam and Eve was able to live together with this divine revelation. But then an error occurred. And the result of the error was the concealment of the divine. And after that first error of eating from the tree, there were more errors, serious errors. Cain killed Abel, and so on. And the divine was completely hidden. And then came a process of bringing the revelation of the divine back into the world. And that went step by step. And finally, we come to Moses, and Moses is building the sanctuary, and here we have at the beginning of the section Truma. Now, Truma, first of all, we have a whole list of items which are going to be used. And this is quite interesting. Millie, do you feel up to reading?
I don't think I can.
No, so better not. Better not. Okay. Alan, would you like to read? Maybe just read in the English. God spoke to Moses.
God spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the Israelites and have them bring me an offering. Take my offering from everyone whose heart impels him to give.
Right. Now, that's a beautiful thing. His heart impels him to give. I think let's just remember that, you know, flag that statement. His heart impels him to give, so there's a prompting of the heart. And then we come to a list of what's going to be in this offering. Nigel, would you like to read it? The offering that you take?
The offering that you take from them shall consist of the following: gold, silver, copper, sky blue wool, dark red wool, wool dyed with crimson worm, linen, goat's wool, reddened ram skin, blue crocus skin, acacia wood, oil for the lamp, spices for the anointing oil, and the sweet smelling incense, and sardonyxes, and other precious stones for the ephod and breastplate. They shall make me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell among them. You must make the tabernacle and all its furnishings following the plan that I'm showing you.
Right, so first of all, there's this list of precious, basically precious, valuable, valuable commodities. Gold, silver, copper, different kinds of dyed wool. And then it speaks of precious stones. And it mentions the ephod and the breastplate, which are two parts of the priestly garments, which are going to be in Sedrat Tetzaveh. This is the, we're reading now from the beginning of Sedrat Truma. But it's speaking about things which are also going to be used in Sedrat Tetzaveh. And then it says, they shall make me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them. Now that is verse 8. Now, can you have a look at verse 8 in the Hebrew? Would you like to read?
Yeah, Vasuli Mikdash Veshachanti Betocham.
Right, can you translate?
But Mikdash is the holy. They shall make me a holy place.
A holy place.
A sanctuary. Veshachanti, I don't know.
Veshachanti and I will dwell.
I'll dwell Betocham.
Now, betocham, this is an interesting word, because it's in the plural.
Amongst them.
Well, that's the way the translator has found to make sense of this word. Because betoch...
Within them.
Within, yes.
I said more within, isn't it? Yes.
It's within. Yeah. Now, but the problem is, it's within, why isn't it within it? They should make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell within it. So the sages explain that it's betoch kol echad ve'echad. God will dwell within each individual.
Yeah.
The making of the sanctuary is establishing and complementing the presence of the divine in the heart of each individual. So that's what it means. I will make they should make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell within them. I'll dwell within their hearts. So an easy way of getting round this linguistic issue is to translate, I will dwell among them. So that is what
midst.
In their midst. Yes. Okay. So that's what the translator does. However, the other meaning, where it's saying that the sanctuary triggers or is triggered by, it's an interesting question, what comes first? But it complements, there are two complementary concepts, the divine presence dwelling in the sanctuary and the divine dwelling in the heart of each individual. And then we have the idea of the making of the sanctuary, and there's a key concept which I thought we would also look at from Sedra Truma, which is the first of the objects which are made. Would you like to go on, please? Make an ark.
Make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. Cover it with a layer of pure gold on the inside and outside, and make a gold rim all around the top.
Right, so we're talking about a box.
Yes.
It's a wooden box made of acacia wood with gold overlay on both sides, both inside and outside and on top. So there's no wood showing whatsoever. You see that? There's a gold rim all around its top as well. Right. And then cast 4 rings. Michael, would you like to read?
Cast 4 gold rings for the ark and place them on its 4 corners. 2 rings on one side and 2 on the other side. Make 2 carrying poles of acacia wood and cover them with a layer of gold. Place the poles and the rings on the sides of the ark so that the ark can be carried with them. The poles must remain in the ark's rings and not be removed. It is in this ark that you will place the testimony that I will give you.
Right. So in other words, the tablets of stone with the Ten Commandments engraved on them, they are going to be placed in this golden ark. And it's interesting that this golden ark is going to have staves. You can see in the drawing beneath. It shows a picture of the ark, a plan view, not plan view, but it's a view from the top. And you can see on the right and on the left the staves which were used for carrying the ark. That's, even though it says that Aaron noseh et atzmo, the ark carried itself. So it was a sort of a spiritual thing, but nonetheless people had...
Is there been any explanation why the staves shouldn't be removed?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. Michael, our ultimate manager. Well, that's... where do they keep them? A friend of mine who produces one of these weekly discussions of the Torah, basically based on the teachings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he wrote a very interesting discussion of this, that the ark is really, it's there sitting in the Holy of Holies, in the sanctuary. And the ark is there, and in fact, most of the time, no one comes anywhere near it. It is behind a curtain. If you turn a couple of pages, there's a diagram. See that, Lily?
Yeah.
Now, if you look on the left-hand side, there is a picture of the sanctuary as a totality with the outer perimeter fence. And in it is the smaller structure, which is actually a wooden structure covered with curtains. And on the right-hand side of the diagram is that structure enlarged. And if you look near the top of the picture, which is the west of the picture, there is the ark in the Holy of Holies. And you can see that the staves, in fact, they are touching the curtains. There's a curtain which divides between the Holy and the Holy of Holies. And the staves of the ark are like making a mark in the curtain. They are pushing the curtain. The Talmud says, like nipples of a woman showing, as it were, through her dress or projecting through the dress. So there is the staves of the ark. There is that That's the way they describe them.
Sorry.
Now, no one goes into this area, this Holy of Holies, except the high priest on the Day of Atonement. Otherwise, no one goes there. So there is a sense in which the ark is there still, by itself, still. Whereas the other part, the outer part of this structure, every day someone comes in and offers incense on the little golden altar which is there in the middle, and someone comes and lights the menorah which is there on the left, and once a week the bread which is on the table on the right, that is a kind of a table, it says there a table, that golden table, there are 12 loaves of bread put on that table. So there's something happening in the outer part every day, but on the inner part it's only once a year. So there is this sense of stillness and aloneness about the ark. Now my friend Yossi Lou, Rabbi Yossi Lou from Atlanta, Georgia, so he writes, and I asked him for the reference, and he sent me fascinating references for everything except this part. But maybe I missed it. Maybe it is there, but it might be his chiddush. The ark is still, but the staves represent movement. The staves which represent movement are always there. So it's like a combination of stillness and movement at the same time, which I thought was a very interesting perception. And he sent me a reference to a sikha by the Rebbe, which I looked up, and it spoke indeed intriguingly about the ark, the way the ark is still, the way the ark is in the Holy of Holies, and no one comes near it most of the time. But it didn't mention the thing about the staves. Maybe, you see, he was working from the original text on which the printed sikha, the printed talk is based. So it might be something mentioned in the original text, but it's not. It didn't come out in the printed version. So that's room for further research. However, I think it's a wonderful perception. It might be Yossi Lu's own perception. But it's a wonderful perception because it's saying that the ark is a combination of opposites. And that's something that the Talmud emphasizes. See, while we're on the subject of the ark, we saw that the ark was 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. Right? Now, if we look at this diagram on the right, let me tell you that the size of this enclosure is 10 cubits. In fact, it's a cube. The Holy of Holies is a cube, 10 cubits long, 10 cubits wide, and 10 cubits high.
So four times the length of the ark.
Four times, all right. Yes, four times the length of the ark. Oh,
no, the ark.
Of the ark, yes. Yes, so the ark is 2.5, and so that's four times, yes. However, the sages tell us, there's a phrase, Ha'aron eino min hamida. How would you translate that, Lily?
The cabinet, or whatever one would call it, is not of a size.
It's not of a size,
of
yes.
Of a size.
You might say is beyond measure, is not measurable.
That's right, not measurable.
It's not, the ark is not measurable. And what it explains in the Talmud is that the distance from the left wall to the right wall is 10 cubits. But if you measure the distance from the left wall to the left end of the ark, it's 5 cubits. And if you measure the distance from the right wall to the right end of the ark, it's 5 cubits. So that means that although the ark is there in front of you and it's 2.5 cubits wide, long, it doesn't have a size. And when you start measuring, it's as if it's naught. And similarly in the other direction. that if you measure from the west wall to the western side of the ark, you'll get 5 cubits, and from the curtain to the eastern side of the ark, you get 5 cubits, as if the ark itself takes up no space whatsoever. So the idea that the ark is beyond space, and this is really something very crucial to the consciousness of the Jewish people, because at the heart of the Jewish people is the temple. I mean, this sanctuary was then transferred into the temple in Jerusalem, where it's the ark is there as well. So there in the temple in Jerusalem, that is the Tzion, that is this special spiritual spot. And when we enter into the Holy of Holies, there is the source of wisdom. It is from this ark, from between the two Kerubim, the two cherubs that God would speak to Moses and dictate to him teachings which he wrote down in the Torah. And so all knowledge is there, and there were the tablets with the Ten Commandments, and also later when Moses completed the Torah scroll, a Torah scroll was put there, either in the ark or next to the ark. So there was a Torah scroll there as well. And that point is beyond measure. It's somehow beyond space. And in addition, if we follow the Yossi Lu's adaptation of the Rebbe's perception of the stillness of the ark, combined with the dynamic posture of having these two staves there as well. So it's still, and yet it's moving. And it is there, and yet it takes up no space. So that's at the heart. That's at the heart of the sanctuary. And if we just finish reading about the two Kruvim, make 2 golden cherubs. Shaul, would you like to? That's back on page 385.
18.
Verse 18, yes. That's right, Vasita.
Vasita
Kaporet?
Vasita Shnaim Kruvim. Vasita Shnaim
Lovely. Can you translate?
Can you do that now in Ashkenazi?
Yes, I can.
Make two. It doesn't sound the same.
Make 2 golden cherubs, hammering them out from the 2 ends of the cover. 1 cherub shall be on 1 end and 1 on the other. Make the cherub from the same piece of gold as the cover itself on its 2 ends. The cherub shall spread their wings upward so that their wings shield the cover. The cherub shall face one another, but their faces shall also be inclined downward toward the cover.
Right, so there's this sense of the cherubim with outstretched wings facing each other, but also facing downwards.
Could I comment on that? And this is something that came back to me every time I read it, but the first time it was when I was a child, because we remember very clearly Lo Ta'aseh Lecha Pesel V'Masechah, and the whole idea of the calf and the rituals that was going on with other nations at the time. And then we have this, and how is there an explanation to it? I mean, do I make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It's very paradoxical. It's very paradoxical that there we have the idea that there should be no graven image, no image of the divine, and all kinds of concerns about images and statues. And there, within the Holy of Holies, we have 2 kruvim. More than that, The two kruvim are described as one being male and one being female. And the sages tell us that they actually moved when there was a time of goodwill towards the Jewish people. They were embracing as if they were making love to each other. And when it was a time of anger from God to the Jewish people, they were back to back. And there is a story that when the Romans, no, not the Romans, when Nebuchadnezzar came into the temple and he went into the Holy of Holies, and there were the two kruvim on the ark embracing, and he said, look at that, what the Jews serve. They make this fine philosophical posture that they don't have any kind of graven images. And look at this, there's this interlocked couple there on top of their ark. So there's a fascinating discussion of this by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which in this he doesn't address the question that you're asking, but which we'll look at in a moment. But what he does discuss is the fact that at the moment of the destruction of the temple, they are interlocking, they're not back to back. They are interlocking. So the idea that even when something devastating is happening, like the destruction of the temple, in fact, it can be somehow or other, it's an expression of God's love, even though it's not understood how it's an expression of God's love. But at the very heart, there is this expression of love. However, we come back to Millie's question. How can it be that there are these images? Well, the fact is that in the temple, there were images. Not only the kruvim, but there were designs in the... first of all, there were designs in the Mishkan. Rashi says the tapestries had an eagle on one side and a lion on the other side. So there were all kinds of images of creatures. And in Solomon's temple, there were also images. When we look in the Book of Kings, where it describes the making of Solomon's temple, there were the kruvim, but also there were other designs of human forms in Solomon's temple as well. So although there is the general injunction not to have any kind of graven image, this graven image is there. But the interesting thing is, it's in a place where no one can see it, because it's in the Holy of Holies. The only person who ever goes in the Holy of Holies is the high priest,
yeah,
once a year. And it's like an esoteric dimension.
Fire as well on Shabbat.
Yes, and that's a very good point, because the law is that you mustn't light a fire on Shabbat. And on the other hand, in the temple, there was a fire on the altar, and certain sacrifices were offered on Shabbat. A very reduced number of sacrifices. Only the communal sacrifices on behalf of the whole Jewish people. So the sacrifice that an individual might want to bring.
But this is such a contradiction.
Well, Judaism has never been black and white.
No, but what is the reason for not lighting a fire?
God says, don't light a fire. But in the temple, there is a fire.
So don't light a fire, or don't work on the Shabbat, and lighting a fire was considered work.
But yeah, is the fire in the temple kept burning, or is it lit?
It's kept burning.
Oh, that's
so you want to say, yeah, like a Shabbat stone.
But the sacrifice.
But the point is,
the sacrifice.
That's
is
right.
God made
got it.
For the people, not for the individual.
Yeah. It's made for the people as a whole. Yeah.
For the nation as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lamb in the morning and a lamb in the afternoon, and then there's the musaf, the additional offering for Shabbat. So this corresponds to the prayers that we say. The shacharit is for the lamb in the morning. The mincha is for the lamb in the afternoon. The musaf is the number of animals that were offered as the extra. Musaf means extra, the extra offering for Shabbat. But you were putting, they were putting the animal, they would slaughter the animal, which you can't do on Shabbat. And then they were cutting it up and putting it on the fire, which you can't do on Shabbat. You can't, if you got, you might light the fire before Shabbat.
But you can't use it.
But you can't put something on the fire. You can have a Shabbat stove with something covering the flame, and you can leave something.
Yes.
That's how we have a whole lot of Jewish recipes for long-term cooking.
Yeah.
You know,
chamin.
Chamin, that's right. Yes, so different kinds. Yes. So
did Nebuchadnezzar had a point about when he was mocking the Israelites? Did he have a point, you think? Or the cherubim did not have any image in them?
Well, Nebuchadnezzar's own religious life was filled with images. But, so there we have Judaism, where there is this one image in the middle somewhere hidden. Which, you know, it's interesting that you can have an image which is in the Holy of Holies. But if you take it out of the Holy of Holies, you can't have it. So you can't have an image in a synagogue. You're not even supposed to have a photograph in a synagogue.
Is there a significance in the actual commodity, the material that it's made? I mean, is gold in some way is...
Well,
there is an expression of something, is it?
Well, there is a saying by the sages that in fact gold was only created in order to be used in this sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
But if, and the temple, but if this would have been the only place where gold was found, and gold didn't exist in any other situation, it would take away from our free will in commitment to Judaism, because it would make it so obvious, the truth of the Torah. So there are various points where the sages say, in order to preserve our sense of choice, that it's not obvious, so therefore there's gold everywhere, and in fact many people made idols out of gold or other artifacts out of gold. So there's always, one can look at it in a, it's got an ambiguous quality. But really, the lust, I mean, gold is a very, very mysterious substance. The reason why it's so attractive and so interesting is because it doesn't react with other substances, so it doesn't tarnish.
It's from a volcanic eruption, or what did they say today? No, from something that
not a volcanic eruption.
Not volcanic. It's from a matter or something that hit the earth, and it's found deep.
Well, it's found in many parts of the world. I mean, it's
no, a, but there's a
ore.
Lot more
it's,
than
it's
is unreachable ore, because it's so deep, apparently.
Interesting. Well, AU on the periodic table.
And the symbolism of the fact that these statues... what did he say? They looked like they were embracing, as if they were making love. Now that symbolism, you've once mentioned before that it was the only time that God, that we were equal to God, was during making love.
I don't know about equal to God.
But you use the something similar.
It's certainly a very spiritual time.
A spiritual time, yeah.
Yes, it's a very spiritual time.
So is you think there's a link to that?
Yes. Yes, I mean, if we're exploring the nature of love in Judaism, mm-hmm. I would look at the concept of the kruvim, of the cherubs, in the Holy of Holies.
Okay, so there is a...
As a sense in which the what is happening when the husband and wife are making love is they are somehow imitating or reflecting this divine erotic union. So there is that, which of course is in the Sfirot. We have the divine Sfirot, the male Sfirot, and then there's the feminine Malchut, kingship, which is feminine, and they connect together the male Sfirot, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. They pour those kindness, severity, mercy, victory, submission, dedication. They pour a flow into kingship. And that is this point of unity. So therefore, in many prayer books, it says, L'shem Yichud, for the sake of the unity of the Holy One, blessed be He, and His Shekhinah, and His divine presence, that they should be unified together, which is seen as a unity in the divine name, as if the divine name was separated, and that divine name has to be brought together. So one way of describing it is that the Yud Kei, the Yud and the He are separate from the Vav and the He. Or another way of seeing it, the Yud and the He and the Vav are separate from the last He, and they should be joined together. So that's the that's this spiritual unity, which is the theme of the Sfirot, which is the divine emanations, which is the central narrative of the Kabbalah. And so that's understood to be these cherubs on the ass.
So the only way of sort of, not that anybody saw it, but to show that you're doing these male and female, yeah? Am I making sense on that?
You mean human men?
Yes,
yes.
Yes, it's just a representation.
Well, the unity of husband and wife is a key point of spirituality, and it's not only the point of the moment of their union, and it's their whole life together, which creates a domain. See, the Jewish home is a sacred domain where the indwelling of godliness is there. And so the Lubavitcher Rebbe used the term Mikdash Ma'at, a small sanctuary, referring to a home. It had in the book of Ezekiel, it's used to refer to a synagogue. And the Rebbe added also the home. The home is another such sanctuary. And that sense of closeness to the divine, the indwelling of the divine. Okay, so now we can move on to Tetzaveh. So we've had the introduction. It begins just after the diagram. There was the page with the diagram, and then we have Tetzaveh.
Oh, and this one is on the Urim and Tumim v'Choshen.
Sorry, yes.
Ha'orim va'tumim.
Yes, it's there in Tetzaveh.
There's so many fascinating questions about that.
Okay, so we'll hopefully we'll come to at least some. Right, so first of all we have Tetzaveh, va'ata Tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael, you should command the Jewish people, v'yikhu elecha shemen zayit zach, katit lama'or, they should bring to you pure olive oil, beaten for the light, la'alot ner tamid, to raise up a continual light. Now that is speaking about the way in which the menorah is going to be lit, and it's saying that you, meaning Moses, should command the Jewish people and they should bring you pure olive oil. Now it's interesting that it says you, Moses. In fact, this Sedra Tetzaveh, Shaul, this was your Bar Mitzvah Sedra.
Yeah.
What is unique about Tetzaveh compared with all the other Sidrot in the Torah, in the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers? One unique fact, something which is not mentioned in this Sedra, but is mentioned in every other Sedra, from the beginning of Exodus all the way through to the end of the book of Numbers.
God told Moses to tell them? So he was passing on a command rather than telling them to.
That's he would not be there in Israel.
God's name is not appearing?
God's name appears, but there's someone else's name that doesn't appear.
Moses.
Moses' name does not appear in this setting. Since the birth of Moses, at the beginning of the book of Exodus, Moses' name occurs in every single sefer, until the book of Deuteronomy, which is all the words of Moses himself. These are the words, the book of Deuteronomy begins, these are the words which Moses spoke to the Jewish people, and the rest of the book is him speaking. So it's in the first person, the book of Deuteronomy, whereas everything else is in the third person. The book of Deuteronomy is Moses actually speaking. But everywhere else, in every other sedra, Moses' name is there, and in this sedra, it's absent. Now, this intrigues scholars. So, in the next sedra, Ki Tisa, there is a discussion between Moses and God. The Jewish people made the golden calf, and as a result of that, God wanted to wipe them out. And Moses is pleading with God, and he says to God, "Mecheni na misifchecha asher katavta. Please wipe me out from the book that you are writing. Wipe me out of the Torah." That's his expression of concern to defend the Jewish people. So there's a saying that the words of the righteous always have an effect, and so therefore his name is missing from this seven.
Only once.
That's right. So that's the sort of expression of the fact that he said that. However, his presence is here because the first word of the Sedra is Va'ata, and you, meaning you, Moses. And saying you, it's like the essence of the person beyond their name, on a higher level than their name. Now there's a very beautiful discussion of just these words, you Moses, Tetzaveh B'nei Yisrael. Now this is something that you referred to. What does it mean, Moses command the Jewish people? Moses' role is to transmit God's command to the Jewish people. It's God who does the commanding. And God says, tell the Jewish people to do something. It's like, it's in God's name. So you're transmitting a teaching from God. What does it mean, you command the Jewish people? So there is a discussion about the meaning of the word tetzaveh. And while, which of course is the root of the word mitzvah, which is a command, but tziva means commanded. That's the root. The three-letter root of commanding is tziva, tzadik vavhe. But there is another word in Aramaic, tzavta. And tzavta means connection.
Togetherness.
That's right, togetherness. Togetherness. We get it in a modern Hebrew word, tzevet. Tzevet means a crew, like the crew of a tank. It's the tzevet. The group put together, in a closely bonded group. So, v'ata tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael, you should connect the Jewish people to God. That's the role of Moses. Moses' role is connecting the Jewish people to God. And so that's the idea of this first verse. And then it starts speaking about the sacred garments which are going to be used for Aaron and his sons. So, Alan, would you like to read 28:1? Separate your brother Aaron.
Separate your brother Aaron and his sons from among the Israelites, and bring them close to you, so that Aaron and his sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Tamar, can become priests to me. Make sacred vestments that are both dignified and beautiful for your brother Aaron. Speak to everyone who is naturally talented, to whom I have granted a spirit of wisdom, and let them make Aaron's vestments. These vestments will then be used to consecrate him and make him a priest to me.
Right. It's interesting, the people who are naturally talented, the actual Hebrew says, kol chachmei lev, all who are wise of heart. So here we have the wisdom of the heart being used in order to create these vestments. And then it goes through a list of them. Nigel, would you like to read down page 417, verse 4? These are the vestments.
These are the vestments that they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a knitted tunic, a turban, and a sash. Make them a sacred vestments for Aaron and his sons, so that they will be able to be priests to me. The skilled workers shall take the gold, the sky blue, dark red, and crimson wool, and the linen.
Right, and with that, they're going to make these different garments. And so, first of all, we have the ephod. So, now the ephod is a mysterious garment. It's mentioned a few times in the Tanakh. And it seems to be a garment which is worn by someone who is doing something priestly. It's something which is kind of a priestly garment. Now the question is, how? What does it look like? And if you look at the diagram below, I wonder if you can make it out. You see, it's like an apron. Do you see this? The left-hand picture looks like an apron with two shoulder straps and a high belt. Now, the thing about this apron is it goes round the back, not round the front. So it's not like an ordinary apron that someone would put on to wear round the front.
The straps are in front.
Yes. So the apron is worn at the back and is done up at the front. Now, Rashi explains this in the Chumash, in his commentary on the Chumash. And he explains it in terms of a certain kind of riding vestment that women would wear in Russia's time, in medieval France. It would be interesting for some historian of costume to try and track this down. But he says women would wear a leather apron sitting on a horse, maybe side saddle. They would wear this leather apron at the back, which is coming between them and the horse, obviously. And so it's a kind of a riding apron. So that would be an interesting piece of...
The word ephod is used also in modern Hebrew.
Well, yeah, but in modern Hebrew, don't forget, it's taken by the, you know, the Baal HaLashon or Ben Yehuda,
he brought the word in order to describe a vest.
A vest?
Yeah, and in the army, bulletproof vest is Ephod Magen.
Ephod Magen.
I was thinking of that with the drawing, like a flak jacket.
Spiritual flak jacket.
Interesting. All right, spiritual flak jacket. Yeah.
Could be something in there.
So, the two, if we look at the left-hand thing, so it goes round the back, then the belt fastens at the front, and the two shoulder straps come down. The two shoulder straps come down. Now those two shoulder straps are going to connect to what is called the breastplate. So then, those shoulder straps connect with the breastplate, which is on the chest of the high priest. This is the garment of the high priest. However, so let's read a description of this. And there are also two, he calls it sardonyx stones. So let's see the actual description of the aphid. Michael, would you like to?
Can I ask a question about?
Yeah.
Oh, we haven't read it yet, probably, because he's talking about Cheshmashzar and linen and wool.
Right.
Isn't it?
Shatnez. Quite right. The clothes, the garments of the Kohanim included shatnez.
Goodness.
So there's a saying in the Talmud, if you want to sin, go to a... it's a rather shocking statement. Go to a place where no one knows you, wear black, and go ahead. I suppose eventually you're supposed to repent as well. But you might say, you know, if you want to do something like breaking Shabbat or something like that, go to the temple. There will be offered the offering on a Shabbat, or you want to wear shatnez, okay, if God has made you a priest, you will be able to wear the priestly clothing, but you can only wear it at the time of the actual service.
Yeah.
It's interesting. See, the things that are forbidden have a certain kind of magnetism in them, which can only be used in very certain situations.
In the Holy of Holies.
So it's not that the graven image in itself is something terrible and disgusting. It's that the graven image has a power which can only be used in the Holy of Holies. It can only be revealed there. And the wool and linen mixed together, which is shatnez, has a spiritual energy which can only be used on the clothes of the Kohanim and cannot be for ordinary clothing. And making a fire on Shabbat is something which cannot be permitted except when you're bringing an offering in the temple. So it's another way of understanding these prohibitions. That everything has a certain kind of energy, and it's a matter of using the energy in the right thing. Whose go is it to read?
Michael. Michael with melody.
Michael? These workers, the aphon on page 417.
These workers shall make the aphon out of gold thread, sky blue, dark red, and crimson wool, together with twined linen in a patterned brocade. It shall have two attached shoulder pieces at its own corners, and these shall be sewn to it. The ephod's belt, which is made in the same manner as the ephod itself, shall be woven together with out of gold thread, sky blue, dark red, and crimson wool and twined linen.
Right, so there it is, made out of all these different threads twined together, including wool and linen. And then we have Shaul. Take two sardonyx stones. Next will be Italian. Italian midnight.
That was Ashkafardi.
Sardonyx?
Yeah, well, I normally call it onyx.
Onyx, okay. Stones are engraved on them. The names of Israel's sons. There should be six names on one stone and the remaining six names on the second stone in the order of their birth. The names of Israel's sons should be engraved by a skilled jeweler, like the engraving on a signet ring. This stone shall then be placed in gold settings. Place the two stones on the two shoulder pieces of the ephod as a membrane stones for Israel's sons. Aaron should carry their names on his two shoulders before God as a remembrance.
Right. So there we have the on the shoulder pieces. You see, there are these shoulder straps coming down from behind. And on that shoulder piece, there is a gem on each shoulder. And the gem, he here says it's sardonyx, which he describes. Do you see the note on the bottom of the right-hand page? Sardonyx is a type of crypto-crystalline quartz related to agate. But I must say, a more common translation for shoham is simply onyx, black onyx. But here, according to his description, it's got alternating red and white bands. Anyway, on this stone is engraved the names of the Bnei Israel.
The tribes.
Yes. Now the that's right, the tribes, sorry, the 12 tribes. And if we go on to the next page, page 419, in the commentary, we have here a discussion about the way in which, then he gives another meaning to Shoham as beryl, as a bluish green stone. It was one of the stones of Eden. It's mentioned there in Genesis about Eden. Then there's a question about the shape. Some say they were hemispherical, some say they were square, some say they were round. And then there is the engraving of their names, and he gives a number of different opinions. Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Dan, Naphtali on the right-hand stone, Gad, Asher, Zvulun, Joseph, Binyamin on the left-hand stone. And so then there are other opinions about that. But the main thing is that all the 12 tribes are on these 12, on these two stones. Now there's also going to be the breastplate, which has got 12 stones. And on those 12 stones are also engraved the names of the tribes. So the names of the tribes appear twice.
For some reason, Issachar is missing.
That must be a...
And the fourth one's with Issachar, and the fifth one's with Issachar.
No, there are 11 on the... doesn't it?
And the first one is not 11 yet.
No, in the commentary.
Yeah, in the commentary.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would have thought that that's a misprint in the commentary. Yeah. I think because he doesn't say anything about that. That seems to be a misprint. See, the last the two last lists have Issachar.
That's right.
I think it must be a mistake. Now, what's interesting, there's one name that appears on these shoulder now, and the tradition is there were 25 letters on each stone. What is pervasive here is the whole idea of names, the names of the Jewish people, the names of the 12 tribes, and also the divine name. Because when we come to the breastplate, there is the breastplate with its stones on which also are the names of the tribes. But inside the breastplate is the Urim V'Tumim.
What
is the Urim V'Tumim?
What is it? I mean, this
Well, what Rashi...
I'm walking with this for years, of this wanting to know what some explanation that to...
Okay, I'm just opening up. But let's first of all read about the... let's read about the breastplate. That's on page 421. Alan, would you like to make... 421.
Make a decision?
Well, that's how he translates these words, Choshen Mishpat, the breastplate of judgment. So he calls it a decision breastplate, not one of his best
translations.
Yeah.
Breastplate. It shall be patent.
Patent.
Patent, brocade, like the ephod.
So in other words, it's initially it's cloth, but the cloth, as it's going to say, what it's made of.
Make it out of gold thread, sky blue, dark red, crimson wool, and twined linen. When folded over, it shall be span long and a span wide.
Right, so a hand breadth. It's...
span is this, isn't it?
From little finger to thumb,
yes.
Yes.
Hand breadth would be there.
Yes, yes, you're right. Yes, Zara.
It's always pretty much 20 centimeters.
Yes. Yes.
Set it with four rows of mounted stones.
So it's half a cubit. So so he gives a measure 9 inches. Right, so now we have the four rows of mounted stones. So should we go through that, Nigel?
And the first of these rows shall contain a carnelian, an emerald, and a topaz. The second row, carbuncle, sapphire, beryl. It's a shame you're not singing this, actually. I don't know if I'm sort of the same.
Not at all.
The Hebrew is probably easier than English. The third row, jacinth, agate, and that thing.
Amethyst.
The amethyst. Fourth row, chrysolite, onyx, jasper. These stones shall be placed in gold settings. The stone shall contain the names of the 12 sons of Israel, one for each of the 12 stones. Each one's name shall be engraved as on a signet ring to represent the 12 tribes.
Now, these stones are very intriguing, and we've got a long commentary here. Now, the second piece of paper that I gave you is the same commentary, but it's just easier to read. Mm. It's been expanded from another edition where there's only the English. And let's have a look at a bit of this. So I think if we turn to the... Right, so on page 243 of this second version, stones. So he mentions there, here there's a question whether the stones are square or round also. There was a discussion about the shape of the stones on the shoulder pieces, whether they're square or round. Here too there's also the same question. And then he goes through a list of these stones. So should we start with carnelian? Odem. Would you like to read that? Let's
carnelian. Carnelian. Odem in Hebrew. The carnelian is a variety of flesh-colored crypto-crystalline quartz having a color similar to ruby due to traces of ferrous oxide. Ancient Greek sources translate it as sardion, septic, Josephus was. The sardion, sardine, or sard, was a deep orange-red variety of carnelian which was finally assigned as the capital of ancient Lydia. Most sources agree that it was a red stone. Yes, right. Some sources state that the odem here was a ruby. However, in ancient nomenclature, the name given to a stone is denoted its visual appearance rather than chemical composition. Hence, the ruby could be a bright red stone.
Any bright red stone.
According to most authorities, the odem was the stone of Reuben. According to some, however, it was the stone of Judah.
Right. So there we have this first stone, which is red, either of Reuben or of Judah, and it might have been a ruby or some other kind of stone which looked red.
I'm completely lost. Where are you reading from?
Yeah.
Page 243.
The
notes at the bottom.
Oh, there.
Yeah,
thank you, Jerry. This one.
Yes, so we've just read about the. So now we're up to emeralds.
There.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. So the next one is emeralds. So, of course, nothing is quite what it seems. So let's see what he says about emeralds. Michael, would you like to read about emeralds? So he gives a string of sources. Emerald. Pitada. Do you have that on page?
Below.
Emerald. Sadia, even. Yeah, over there.
Yeah, never mind the sources. Yeah.
Most of the sources also indicate that it was green stone. One early source identifies it as prasma, Spanish for praise. A dark green variety of crystalline quartz. It can also denote chrysoprase, an apple green variety, or plasma, a leek green or emerald green type. Ancient Greek sources translate pitada as topaz, where the sequence is sardion topaz emerald. However, it appears that the mainstream tradition had a reading in the Septuagint Sardian emerald topaz.
Yeah, the Septuagint is an ancient Greek translation of the Torah.
Oh, the Torah, the seven, yeah.
Yeah, so...
By 70.
That's right, made by 70, Satan. Yeah.
Hence, the picta would be translated as smaragdos, Greek for emerald or malachite. Nonetheless, there are a number of later sources that identify the picta with topaz, There are, however, some indications that the topaz of the ancients was actually green.
So there's a reference to Pliny showing that topaz, as spoken about by the Greeks, was green and not...
The pitta was the stone of Shimon. Others say that it was the stone of Issachar.
Okay,
inevitably
there's disagreement about which tribe, but it's interesting that generally it seems to move towards a green stone. So the idea of calling it emerald makes sense. Whether it's actually the emerald that we have today or some other stone, but it's a green, it seems like a green stone. Shol, topaz.
Topaz, bereket in Hebrew. Numerous sources indicate that it was a stone that was yellow. If it's assumed that the serpentine transposes this stone with the one above, then it would also translate that as topazion, Greek for topaz or similar yellow gemstones.
Okay, I tell you what, let's just go on to the bottom of that section where he says which tribe it is.
Which tribe is it? Yeah,
The Berechet was the stone.
The Berechet was the stone of Levi. Others state that it was the stone of Zebulun.
Right. So we have, again, you know, different opinions. But so it's basically a yellow stone, or saffron coloured, and it's the tribe of Levi or Zebulun. Now he quotes the Targum Yonatan. Uh, Oh, I see. That's interesting. The Targum Yonatan, which I've got in my hand, gives the names of the tribes. As it's giving the names of the stones, it also gives the names of the tribes. And then we have Kabanko. Should we look at that, Alan? That's at the bottom of the page. The last line, page 243.
Kalbanko was a pizza.
Kalbanko was the Kalbanko annex to the National Gallery.
Nefeya?
Nofech.
Nofech in Hebrew. Ancient Greek sources translate Nofech as Othrax, Anthrax, donating coal. This is usually interpreted to mean a mineral that is red, the color of burning coal. The word again, the phrase on stones. It is hence rendered in kobanko from the Cuba Latin for coal. This denotes a particularly brilliant red garnet, but also can also denote a ruby or ruby spinel.
All right, well, what he's basically saying, one view red is that spine. It's red, like a burning coal. Others say it's black, like a not burning coal, just like a black coal. And then others say that it's a mixture of colors, black, blue, white. And some say it's pure blue. And then where it, and who is it for? Either the stone of Judah or Reuven. And then we have sapphire, and Nigel.
The sapphire was the stone, this one?
Yeah, it's sapphire in Hebrew.
Sapphire.
But two paragraphs higher than that.
Oh, sorry. Where am I? Sapphire in Hebrew. In Greek, this is also translated as Septuagint. This, however, denotes any blue stone, and some say that the sapphire of the ancients was really the lapis lazuli. Some sources, however, state that the biblical sapphire was actually a clear, colourless stone, identified either as crystal or diamond.
Interesting. All right, so there are different ways of understanding this. The word sapphire is very, sapphire is very significant in biblical and rabbinic sources. The word sphira comes from the word, it relates to the word sapphire. And the word sapphire means to express, le saper, to tell, like sipur, a story. So, hashamayim mesaprim kavod kel, the heavens tell the glory of God. So the idea of sapphire blue or sapphire looking like a diamond, expressing the brightness, expressing the brightness of spirituality.
What is mentioned in Maaseh Merkava? There is a stone mentioned there.
I think that is sapphire.
Sapphire,
well, I'm not sure if that's in Maaseh Merkava. In the description of the vision of godliness at Sinai, it speaks about Evan Sapphire. It speaks about sapphire stones. But there it's blue because it says, Ke'etzem Hashemayim Lutoha, pure like the essence of the heavens. You know, so blue like the sky, clearly. So that would tip it to the side of a blue stone. And then comes the question of whose stone it is. It says it's Yisachar, and others say the stone of Dan. So
that opinion says it's Shimon.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Very clear about this.
Okay, then we have 1819, Jacinth, I've never heard of before. Leshem in Hebrew. which is a bright and orange stone, often likened to the carbuncle or amber. So, but then there are other views, whether it's a blue or orange, and it's understood this Leshem, it was the stone of Dan, and others say Gad and Ephraim. But in fact, Leshem was a city in the area of Dan. And then we have Agate, and so it goes on. So actually, Alan, I photocopied this whole thing for you to show your wife. Talking point.
Yes, it's too much.
A talking point with you.
What have you got her to blame for?
Oh, sorry. Right. So then we see on, if we go back to the Hebrew text, and we look on page 425, or 424, we get an idea of the way the breastplate is there positioned on the high priest, with the 12 stones on the breastplate. And we're now, and if we move on to page 427, the top of page 427 in the English, or in the Hebrew, "Benasa Aaron et Shmot Bnei Yisrael b'choshen ha'mishpat al libo b'vo'o el ha'kodesh l'zikaron lifnei Hashem tamid." Aaron will carry the names of the children of Israel on the breastplate of judgment on his heart when he comes into the holy place as a memory before God always. So he's carrying the names of the children of Israel. It reminds me of the Siddur that the Baal Shem Tov had. Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov had a Siddur, and the Siddur has a prayer book which has been preserved, and it's in the Lubavitch Library in New York. It's a manuscript Siddur, and in the Siddur are the names of his followers, many of his followers, their names, because while praying he would think of their names. So it's like here, the high priest comes into the Holy of Holies, or into the holy place, wearing the names of the names of the Jewish people.
For God's heart. Where's his heart? How many were there?
Of the Baal Shem Tov's disciples? I don't know. It's said that there were 60 close disciples. How many? Whether it was 60 names in the prayer book, I don't know. It's, I have seen that page. It's been on display.
Nowadays it'd be on email, wouldn't it? Nowadays it'd have an email.
Now we come to the thing that intrigued Millie from childhood. ונתתי חושן המשפט את האורים ואת התומים והיו עלי ואהרון בבוא לפני השם ונשא אהרון את משפט בני ישראל על ליבו לפני השם. So this is verse 30. So whose turn to me?
Place the
Urim
and the Thummim,
yes,
in the decision breastplate. And they shall be over Aaron's heart when he comes before God. Aaron will then carry the decision-making device for the Israelites before God at all times.
Okay, there's a...
What's this?
Sounds like device. A device.
Yes, yeah. He's making... It's a little bit too instrumentalist. Yes. In fact, the basic text in Hebrew just says Aaron will carry the judgment of the Jewish people on his heart before God always, which I think makes better sense.
So it's not to help him.
Yeah.
Judgment decide. Will make decisions.
No,
because if it's kind of premonition coming or information coming, it's like a transistor.
Well, I mean, there's the idea of using the Urim and Thummim as a kind of oracle.
an oracle. Yeah.
Yeah, now first of all, let's just see what Rashi says about the Urim and Tumim. Huktav Shema Mufurash. It is the text of the divine name. Shahayan notno betoch kifrei hachoshen, which he would put between the fold of this breastplate. You see, it's one amma long, it's one cubit long, and then that's folded over so it becomes half an amma. And so now on the outer side are the 12 stones, and inside the fold, yes, is put a piece of parchment or something with the divine name written on it. And that is the Urim v'Tumim.
Right.
Now, in the second temple, they have the breastplate, but they didn't have that parchment. They didn't have the divine name. They didn't know exactly how to write the name in the right way, and it wasn't there. But the according to many opinions. So therefore, in the second temple, they didn't use the breastplate in this oracular way.
Right.
So the way it's described, using the breastplate in this oracular way, was that the king would come and he would ask a question of the high priest. And the high priest would look at the breastplate in front of him, and he would see, as you see, there's words, there's the names of the 12 tribes. And in those words, he would somehow see the answer, as if, sometimes described, it would light up. The right words would light up. So there's a story about Eli, the high priest, at the time when Hannah, the mother of Samuel, was praying in the sanctuary. And she was praying very earnestly, and he didn't know what she was doing.
He thought she was drunk.
That's right.
So one of the explanations of this is that he looked at the gems on the breastplate, and he saw the letters Shin, Kaf, Resh, Hey, which he interpreted as Shikora, drunk.
Yeah.
So he got angry with her. Why are you drunk? What are you doing coming into the temple, into the sanctuary, drunk? And she says, I'm not drunk. I'm just very upset because I haven't had any children. And in fact, we learn how to pray from her. She prayed with her lips moving, but without a sound coming out of her lips. And that's how we pray the Amidah.
Awesome.
So it's from Chana that we learn that technique of praying, this sort of intense, silent prayer. Anyway, so the sages say the letters, the right letters, lit up, as it were. But he read them wrong. It should have been Kashera. She is Kasha. She is
fit.
Oh,
I see. And he read it, yes.
So, if you're using oracular methods, you have to be
careful.
All right, so there we have these clothes of the Kohanim. I'd like to go on now to the very end of the Sedra. The very last page, page 439. Right, so it goes through all the clothes of the Kohanim. And now, at the very, very end, Nigel, where it says, chapter 30, the incense altar. Make an altar.
Make an altar to burn incense out of acacia wood. It shall be square, a cubit long and a cubit wide, and 2 cubits high, including its horns. Cover it with a layer of pure gold on its top, its walls all around, and its horns. Make a gold rim all around it. Place 2 gold rings under the altar's rim on its 2 opposite sides as receptacles to hold the poles with which it is carried. Make the carrying poles out of acacia wood and cover them with a layer of gold. Place this altar in front of the cloth partition concealing the testimony ark. Before the cloth partition concealing the testimony area where I commune with you.
Right, so here we have this golden altar. And this is the last thing in the Sedra, and it speaks about how Aaron shall burn incense. Would you like to go on, please?
Aaron shall burn incense on this altar each morning when he cleans out the lamps. He shall also burn incense before evening when he lights the lamps. Thus, for all generations, there will be an incense before God at all times. Do not burn any unauthorized incense on it. Furthermore, do not offer any animal sacrifice, meal offering, or libation on it. Furthermore, once each year, Aaron shall make atonement on the horns of this altar. For all generations, shall make atonement with the blood of the atonement sacrifice once each year. This altar shall be a holy of holies to God.
Right. Now, this altar was used on Yom Kippur. Aaron would come in there was blood from an animal which had been sacrificed in the courtyard outside, but he would come in and sprinkle it on this golden altar. That was the only time it was used in that way. But normally there was the incense which was used. Now, the idea of the idea of this the idea of this golden altar is a very intriguing concept, because after everything, you see, in Sedra Truma, it's got all the different objects. It's got the whole sanctuary and all the different objects that were made in the sanctuary. Then it's got the clothes of the Kohanim in Tzatzaveh, and then finally it's got the golden altar. Why is the golden altar put right at the end? And one of the answers that's given for that is that the golden altar was something where the priest would come in and offer incense on that altar all alone. He would be completely alone. It happened every day, offering incense, as we saw. But he comes in by himself. And it's telling us something about all aspects of divine service, that we are always alone with God. That whatever we're doing, we could be with 1,000 people, but there's also the sense in which we're alone with God. And so these two parashiyot, which are describing this crucial and central relationship with the divine, is also telling us that the ultimate is each individual is together with God, alone, with the fragrance of the incense. And one final point about it. You see, the sanctuary is for korbanot. Now, a korban is an offering, but the word comes from the word which means draw near, karov, near. So a korban is a way of drawing near to God. But when you say drawing near, there's still a sense of distance. Ketoret relates to the word katar, a knot, like kesher. Ketoret suggests incense, the word for incense, suggests being bonded with God. So the offering of the incense, it's not just korban, it's not just drawing near, it's actually being bonded with God. And in the incense, there were 11 ingredients. And ten of the ingredients had a beautiful fragrance. But there was one that had an unpleasant fragrance. And so it's as if the unpleasant fragrance represents that which is bad. And among the Jewish people, the Rashaim, the evildoers of the Jewish people. And nonetheless, they are part of the incense as well. So on Yom Kippur, there is the idea that even the people who are normally banned from the synagogue are allowed to come into the synagogue and welcomed in the synagogue. And in fact, anytime, everyone is welcome to the help of God, because one needs even the...
All of them.
That's right. Everyone has to be there together, making that incense, bonding us to God.
Amen.
Okay, Millie, you should have a refreshing.
Thank you, Tanya, so much. By the way,